Please grab a seat and, yeah, let's turn to that passage. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians 9, we're in this letter. We're in chapters 8 to 10, which is one big section about the rights of Christians, their freedoms, but also their attitude to those. Not one of holding them over against others, but using them in love. We need a bit of a recap. I'm going to take a little bit more time this morning to do that, partly because it's been 2 weeks since we were in chapter 8, and secondly because chapter 9 flows so directly from chapter 8. So, if you've got it in front of you, you can see in chapter 8, we were there introduced to an issue of controversy in the church at Corinth, in that Roman society where pagan idol worship touched so many areas of life. This issue of eating meat that had somehow been involved in being offered to idols in some way, that was just dividing the church. One group was saying, oh, an idol is nothing, really doesn't matter what you do, just eat it, it's food on your plate. But others, those with more recent experience of what that idolatry could do to you and the hold it could have, they couldn't bring themselves to be so blasé about it. But the first group were not acting with sensitivity towards the second group. The knowledge, as we saw, was not accompanied by love. And so their behavior had the potential to lead those with a more tender conscience into sin, to act against their own conscience and therefore into sin. And so Paul's message to that confident group was this. Just a reminder there on the screen. A wise disciple knows that knowledge without love causes harm. And a wise disciple gladly forgoes their freedoms for the sake of others. That's what we looked at last week. Now, I noticed a map of Corinth this week. This is Roman Corinth that Paul would have known and walked around in AD, sort of early 50s. And the most significant temple there is that one to Apollo, right in the center. That's where most of the sacrifices would have been made. And if I show you where the meat market was, it's right there. It's kind of like having a permanent temple smoking out the back car park of Sainsbury's. And the meat there being directly taken into the shelves of the supermarket, and you can go in and buy the stuff. So it's all very relevant, and that map reminds us of that. So this is not an issue that we have to contend with in the same way that they did, but the principles, absolutely, we do. You know, I mentioned the issues of drinking alcohol or getting involved in Halloween. There are many others. We've been discussing some in our discipleship groups. But any situation perhaps where Christians differ are potentially ones where we can cause harm by not being sensitive to another, as Paul puts it, weaker conscience. And as I said a couple of weeks ago, if you consider yourself to be a well-taught Christian, someone with knowledge, someone who knows the Bible well, that actually this is most directly relevant for you. We're more in danger of slipping at this point. So having challenged what they are doing with their rights, Paul now in chapter 9 lets them into the secret of what he has done with his. Okay, so I'm going to read all of chapter 9, starting at verse 1. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not my workmanship in the Lord? If to others I am not an apostle, at least I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. This is my defense to those who would examine me. Do we not have the right to eat and drink? Do we not have the right to take along a believing wife, as do the other apostles? And the brothers of the Lord and Cephas, that's Peter, Aramaic word for Peter. Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working for a living? Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard without eating any of its fruit? Or who tends a flock without getting some of the milk? Do I say these things on human authority? Does not the law say the same? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain. Is it for oxen that God is concerned? Does he not certainly speak for our sake? It was written for our sake, because the ploughman should plough in hope, and the thresher thresh in hope of sharing in the crop. If we have sown spiritual things among you, is it too much if we reap material things from you? If others share this rightful claim on you, do not we even more? Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right, but we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who are employed in the temple service get their food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar share in the sacrificial offerings? In the same way, the Lord commanded that those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. But I have made no use of any of these rights, nor am I writing these things to secure any such provision, for I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting. For if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting, for necessity is laid upon me. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this of my own will, I have a reward, but if not of my own will, I am still entrusted with a stewardship. What then is my reward? That in my preaching I may present the gospel free of charge, so as not to make full use of my right in the gospel. For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them. To the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run so that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. Well, on those last few verses, every couple of years in Corinth, there were some games that took place there. The Isthmian Games, they were held every 2 years. We had the Olympics, of course, not that many years ago, and it feels like a real honor to have that. But they had it regularly. They were the sort of city that had this major event on a very regular basis. And it was second only to the Olympian Games, the ancient Olympian Games over in Olympia. Corinth was the sort of city that boasted a massive sporting event. And you can still see the remains of the starting positions for the running race. You can see it there on the screen. It's possible maybe someone's been to Corinth to see this. There's a starting block that's there with a rope system that ensured that no one started too early. And from what we can work out, Paul was there in Corinth in 51 AD where one of those games took place. And as he observed what was going on, so much of it would have been off-putting to Jews and to Christians as well. And yet some images from that stuck in his head, and I thought, yes, as he wrote this letter later on to Corinth when he'd moved on probably to Ephesus, as he sat down and wrote this letter, he thought about that sporting event. Actually, That gives me a great illustration of what I want to say to my friends in Corinth. Well, what exactly does he want to say? He wants to speak into this issue of how to approach differences, not with knowledge only, but with love that builds up. And so this morning we come to chapter 9. Having made this point about being willing to forego rights in chapter 8, Paul is now essentially in chapter 9 giving himself as an example. It's quite a powerful example. It's powerful because they've seen it in the flesh. It's how he lived amongst them when he had 18 months in Corinth. And basically the chapter divides like this into, firstly, the rights that Paul has in verses 1 to 14. Secondly, the reason that he doesn't make use of those rights from verse 15. And then landing on his illustration of the race in those last four verses. And Paul makes that big appeal, I think, in those verses to have the sort of mindset that the athlete has in that context. And here's my summary of the chapter this morning. Join me, Paul says, join me in sharing the athlete's focus. Willing to shed one's relatively petty rights for the sake of the greater prize. Join me in sharing the athlete's focus, the athlete's mindset, willing to shed one's relatively petty rights in this world for the sake of the greater prize. So first of all, as we think about Paul's rights in verses 1 to 14, Paul has got the right, he says in these verses, to make a living from his gospel labors. And he takes quite a bit of time, doesn't he, all of these verses to establish that right so we can really get his point. So verses 1 to 6, first of all, he's certainly saying, I'm not someone who's muscled in on the movement. On the contrary, Jesus himself gave me this job. An apostle literally means a sent one. He's not sent himself. He's been sent by God. And you can read in Acts chapter 9 about how God took hold of him. He was going one direction on the road, and Jesus sort of took hold of him and turned his life completely around and sent him out there to preach the gospel. In addition, Paul says, the Corinthians, they have evidence of his work amongst them. So verse 2, they're living proof of his very real apostleship. Verses 4 and 5 possibly sound a little bit odd. You know, what's stopping Paul from eating and drinking or getting married? Well, nothing. He's simply making the point that if the church leaders in general at the time had the right to be supported financially, including having their family supported, then that's a right he has too. There's no reason why he should be an exception to that. Now, that's not news to us. We understand what it is to support gospel workers. I stand before you this morning as someone you support as a church. You support me financially in order that I can devote my attention to gospel ministry. I don't have to work as a part-time architect or a Tesco shelf stacker. So I'm grateful for that. And we understand what he's saying. It's not a strange thing for us. In verse 7, he appeals to what he calls human authority. That's language from verse 8. He talks about a soldier getting paid, a vineyard planter who benefits from what grows, or a shepherd getting some of the milk. You know, we can understand that. People who work in something, we expect some sort of salary or some sort of recompense for that. On top of that, in verses 9 and 10, Paul defends this principle from the law of Moses. He quotes from Deuteronomy 25:4, "You shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain." I take it Paul means at the end of verse 9, is it only for oxen that God is concerned? God is concerned about oxen, but more than that, there's a principle of care here for the worker. In verses 11 and 12, I think Paul is arguing from the lesser to the greater and says, if this is true in the case of those who have sown in material ways, how much more is this true for those who have sown in spiritual ways? Now, if you just picked up this section in isolation, what might you think? Or if you saw someone kind of making some notes at work on a sheet, giving these sort of points about why this should get paid. You'd probably think, oh, this guy's building a case, isn't he? He's building a case for a pay rise or something, or a Christmas bonus. Because this is how we think. Isn't that usually why people talk about their rights and defend them? It's nearly always in defense of those rights. So it's surprising when Paul suddenly shifts gear, suddenly in verse 12, he says, no, nevertheless, halfway through verse 12, we've not made use of this right. I'm not saying this to argue for a bonus, far from it. I've got a really different point to make. Instead, we endure everything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. This is his guiding principle in this whole chapter, to do what is most conducive for people hearing the gospel. Now, Paul did this with his tent making. He didn't make use of his rights. He must have given hours during the day, during the week, to this tent making industry. We read about that in Acts 18, verse 3. He was of the same trade with Priscilla and Aquila, and so he stayed with them and, I quote, worked, for they were tent makers by trade. It's worth understanding, though, that that doesn't mean that Paul was never supported financially. He was, including while in Corinth. So in chapter 11 of 2 Corinthians, he makes the point that when I was amongst you, I was supported by other churches. He was not averse to being supported, but the point he's making is that he wasn't supported by them at this point. He gives, after that, more reason, verse 13, about his right to material support. He points to the temple servers who got some of the meat from the sacrifices. And finally, and perhaps most powerfully, he cites Jesus on the subject. No doubt thinking of the times where Jesus sent out his disciples and said, you know, eat what's put before you, a worker is worthy of his wages. Jesus says that a couple of times. So Paul has really established this point, this principle, that the practical support of gospel workers, that is a Bible principle, and he's done so mainly with questions. So I count 17 questions up to verse 13, just ramping them up, because he's getting us to think. He's not just telling us, he's asking questions. There isn't a single command in all of this. He's getting them to think. Perhaps one qualification we should note at this point. What Paul is saying here, I think it doesn't follow that every person doing every sort of Christian ministry should automatically be provided with a living for it. I think any gospel worker actually should first stop and think about whether they can support themselves in what they're doing. And many, many do so. Many pastor churches around the world, whilst doing a vocation at the same time, many do so out of choice or out of necessity. Years ago, Vicky and I asked ourselves that question. But it became clear to us that I couldn't play my part in raising a young family, work in the secular employment that I was in, and follow the call that we believe that God was leading me into without a serious detriment to one of those three things. It became really clear to us. But it is a question that I think all should ask. It's not a simple case of, I'm doing ministry, therefore support me, please. That, of course, can be abused. It gets abused today. It got abused very early on. You see that in John's letters. You see that in other places in the early church. There is a right procedure. God calling, the church testing, praying, giving it approval to. And remember, this section is about the right of Christians to eat meat offered to an idol. Some were really asserting that right, and Paul has acknowledged it. He said, yeah, you've got a theological case for that. It is a right, but you're not using it well. And now he's showing a better way. He too has rights, but now he's explaining why a concern for others has meant he's not actually taken those rights. So let's have a look at the reason that Paul gives for not using those rights. That's what happens in verses 15 to 23. And basically he says, you know, I've got really good reasons for foregoing the real rights that I have that you've just seen that are very real, have a listen to what they are and let it impact your own situation, Corinthians. So, of course, he's already given us the headline in verse 12. It's about not putting obstacles in the way of the gospel. And there's a similar summary right at the end of verse 23. I do it all for the sake of the gospel. But there's more detail in here as well. It's not always easy to discern Paul's argument. It's quite tricky sometimes. It's worth noting that boasting, that word, which usually is a negative thing, isn't it? Paul is using here more positively as a sort of joyful satisfaction in something. But it's really clear that Paul acts from a clear sense of two things. Firstly, from a sense of stewardship, but also from a sense of service. Firstly, stewardship. This is the paragraph, verses 15 to 18. And here, basically, Paul is saying, I'm only doing what I absolutely have to do. God's given me this task that I have no place to get away from it. There's no scope for boasting when you do something that you have to do out of duty. Woe to me, in fact, if I don't do it. Notice the language from verse 17 of being entrusted with a stewardship. A steward was given a bunch of keys. You're given that to look after. You've got to do it. It's a language of duty. He doesn't have a choice. Think about when he was called on the Damascus Road. It's really striking. You look at that experience and God didn't actually give him a choice. God just said, you were doing that. You were persecuting Christians. Now you're going to go and build up Christians. I've decided you've got a different role to play. There's stewardship. We might kind of wonder, what's all this about? I'd rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting, verse 15. I think he's saying as strongly as he can that while he has nothing to boast about by simply doing his duty, he does have a boast when it comes to not taking payment, which would undermine that duty. So in Corinth, there was a sort of thing where there was a patron-client relationship. It was a bit of a thing. You pay me, I do your bidding. And Paul is saying, no, I think maybe that's a reason that Paul is saying I've not taken payment to avoid that. There's stewardship, therefore, in 15 to 18. As well as stewardship, Paul is driven by a sense of service. That's the word in verse 19. I've made myself a servant to all. He started off in verse 1. Am I not free? Yeah, Paul, you are free. Verse 19, free from all, he now says. And yet, Paul is using that freedom to lay himself down. He's using his freedom to serve others. He's not saying, yes, I'm free, and making a massive thing about that. He's using it to serve others. He's willing to be appropriately adaptable in a whole bunch of situations whilst never compromising on sin. To the Jews, verse 20, I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. There's a principle here that we can get really wrong, particularly verse 22, I've become all things to all people. Obviously we can massively abuse that, can't we? We can justify all sorts of wrong behavior. It's best if we let the Bible show us what Paul means by this. So in Acts chapter 16, for example, there's another example in Acts 21. In Acts 16, Timothy joins Paul on mission for the first time. And Timothy was never circumcised because his dad was a Greek. And so they saw that actually it would be helpful for the gospel to circumcise Timothy in that situation. Now, did Paul believe that you needed to be a Christian, needed to be circumcised rather, to be a Christian? No way. And yet, we're told, I quote, because of the Jews who were in those places, end of quote, they had Timothy circumcised. They're acting out of respect and love for the Jews. Probably they're the believing Jews, the Christian Jews, amongst whom Timothy was ministering. So while we must never think that one, circumcision or uncircumcision, commends us to God more than the other. A Christian is free. A Christian is free on these issues to choose them for gospel purposes, not for salvation purposes, but for gospel purposes. As I say, there's a similar example in Acts 21 where Paul goes through a purification process, has his hair cut for similar reasons. And the other side of the coin is true as well. To those outside the law, verse 21, I became as one outside the law. So he doesn't load Gentiles down with Jewish law when, for example, he preaches in Athens or ministers in other places. Jew, Gentile, the other group listed there in verse 22 is the weak. Recognize them? Jew, Gentile, that's normally everyone. That's how the world is divided up. Weak is a surprising third category, but it reminds us that he's actually talking about this situation in Corinth. We've got those who are with tender consciences, those less confident about the food offered to idols. In all of this, Paul is showing how the strong, if you want to call them that, are to behave towards the weak. Don't bash the weak. Don't minimize their concerns. Don't trivialize their theological understanding and their experience. Rather, apply this same principle. Now, this principle, I think it's worth at this point just saying, I think it really finds its basis in what we've seen earlier in the letter. Paul knows that the Christian life is cross-shaped. It's cross-shaped. The Corinthians, though, they're not understanding that. They are, I think, they're seeing the cross, maybe it's the entry point to Christianity, the entry to salvation, and then you kind of have the cross behind you, and you can look back on that slightly embarrassing thing, embarrassing to the Greeks, remember? And you can move on. You can move on to a higher level of spiritual living that doesn't major so much onto the cross. And Paul is saying, no way. He said that back in chapters 1 to 3. And now he is saying, no, the cross does not just save. The cross, I think he's subtly saying here, this is the foundation behind all of this. The cross shapes the whole Christian life. There's a helpful phrase, which some of you may know, that says that the cross is not just the way in to the Christian life. The cross is the way on in the Christian life. It's not just the way in, it's the way on. And the way that the strong are behaving towards the weak shows that they're thinking like it's just the entry point and they don't have to live a cross-shaped life. But Paul is just saying in this whole section, chapters 8 to 10, no, look at my life. Look at what a cross-shaped life is like. Imitate me because I'm living that cross-shaped life. But of course, he's also saying, by saying that, my model is Christ. Because Christ did the cross. Christ lived the ultimate cross-shaped life. Jesus is the great example that lies behind all of this. Think about the rights that Jesus had before he came to earth. He's the second person of the Trinity, the eternal Son of God in heaven. He has the rights to all of the glory of heaven. He has the rights to stay visibly at one with God the Father forever. He has the rights of all of that. And yet, what did he do for the sake of the weak? He willingly took on the form of a servant, came down amongst us, stretched out his hands upon the cross in service of sinners, even to death. To death on a cross, Jesus gave up his rights for the sake of others. You see how that is really at the heart of all of this. Paul is not explicit about this, although at the end he's going to say, be imitators. This is 11 verse 1. Be imitators of me as I am of Christ. We get a clue to it there. But he's basically saying, look, I'm waiving my rights for your sake, Corinthians. That's what I've done. I've stretched out my hands. I've laid my life down for you. And he's calling them to share precisely that mindset on this issue where they're not even willing to do it on this relatively minor issue of eating food offered to idols. Now we land on this final picture then, Paul's race, which he gives to just drum this point home in our ears. Some of the detail we need to look at and think, okay, that's just illustrative. We're not really meant to do that. But it's the mindset here that he's calling us to, the mindset of the athlete. Run like me, run like Christ in these last four verses. He essentially points to those athletes. There's the example I want to use in my letter. There's the example. Because even the athlete is willing to make sacrifices for this relatively paltry gain. I mentioned these games that took place that would have taken place in AD 51 when Paul was there. There was athletics there, there was a whole load of stuff. There was boxing, just as Paul refers to in verse 26. Boxing was in a, I don't know how big a boxing ring is compared to this platform, but we have quite generous rings nowadays. In those days, it was really small, maybe more like this size. You couldn't run anywhere. You couldn't dodge out of the way. I would not like the sound of that. You're just there getting smashed by your opponent. And there was no bell to kind of call time. It was whoever was knocked out or gave up before the other. So it's pretty brutal business. All of this energy, all of this planning that Paul saw when he was there at the Isthmian Games, the diet, the training schedule, all had one thing in view, the prize, the place on the podium, which made all the hard work worthwhile. All these Greek and Roman men running around without their clothes on, which is what they did, one reason that Jews would have nothing to do with it. All for the reward of a bit of fame for a short time and a wreath. That's the word in verse 25. Every athlete exercises self-control. They do it to receive a perishable wreath. It was literally a perishable wreath because it was made of leaves woven together, placed on the head as an award. At this time for the games, it was a wreath of pine leaves. Centuries earlier, it had been celery leaves, believe it or not, under the Greeks. I had a bit of celery in my fridge this week. I looked at it. It's a wilted bit of celery. Now, did I put it on my head or give it as an award to someone? No, it goes straight in the food waste. It is a very perishable thing. And yet they're doing all of that to get a bit of celery leaf on the head, a pine leaf on the head. Bit of praise from man for a short period of time. You might think, well, hold on a minute, I saw the snooker last week and the guy was given £300,000 as a reward. Yeah, he was, but the point still stands. It's still perishable. It might have longer shelf life than a lettuce in your fridge, but the point is, the prize is perishable, Paul says. But what a Christian can look forward to, in contrast, is imperishable. It is imperishable. It won't wilt. If you compare the word wreath here with other times it's used in the New Testament, you see wonderful promises. In 2 Timothy 4, Paul talks about the wreath of righteousness. We often interpret that as a crown, but the word is the wreath word. A wreath of righteousness, Revelation 2, the wreath of life, 1 Peter 5, the unfading wreath of glory. This imperishable wreath that God has for his children, and guess what? Made possible because of the wreath of thorns laid on Jesus' head because he gave up his rights. And earlier in the letter, Paul referred to the day of Christ, the day which tests and reveals and exposes and rewards and all of that. You could say, therefore, that behind is the cross of Christ, which provides us with the way into life and the way on, and before is the day of Christ. That's how Paul is thinking. Behind is the cross of Christ, and before is the day of Christ. The Christian runs the race always with Christ behind and Christ before. And it is precisely the reason that now is just the right time to be making these sorts of sacrifices, letting go of any little petty rights we might have, relatively petty, although they might seem like we want to really grasp onto them. Let them go, though, if they provide an obstacle to me or to anyone else on that race. If anything gets in the way of seeing others in glory, them hearing the gospel now, why would I want to hold on to my little rights? Doesn't this make us want to look at what our rights are that might be good and theologically sound, but actually maybe there are things that getting in the way, actions that might cause another Christian to look at me and to act against their own conscience, to sin. If you do drink alcohol, if you do go clubbing, if you do any of those things that where Christians will differ on, if you do get involved with Halloween, if you do choose to go to a wedding where there's controversy over whether Christians would be involved in it, think about it. Just think about not what's my right, what can I do, what am I free to do, but is it helpful? Will it build others up as well? That's the essential question that Paul is getting us to think about in this section. Why would we not do so? When Christ is behind, Christ lies ahead. Now is the time to make any sacrifice that helps others into the kingdom. We might be able to argue stuff from a position of conviction, and it's essential we have convictions to stand by those key ones, but we've got to put any of those questionable ones through the filter of love, as Paul is causing us to do. The athlete knows that it's just the right time to make sacrifices because I've got the finish line in my sights. They do it for selfish reasons. How much more should the Christian do so willingly and gladly? Now, cross-cultural missionaries, they know this. They know that I need to put rights aside if I'm going to go into that very different culture, what I eat, how I live, all of those expectations I'm going to have to adjust. And it's as though every believer needs to share that mission mindset, Paul is saying. Well, a few questions from this. Does it all sound a bit like hard work to you? Does it sound like hard work? Just one thing to say on that. You know, does it mean, for example, the Christian can never relax or prioritize a good night's sleep or have a quiet, restorative morning or anything like that? But think about the athlete. The athlete is not just about driving their body into the ground. Actually, they're the opposite. They're enabling themselves to perform as well as they can. It's about acting in a way that gets me to the finish line and gets others there. Paul is talking about spiritual things, using an example from a very unspiritual and often quite a selfish world. And so the athlete is not an example for a number of things. Of course, we're not saying it's not about competing against each other. That's obvious, isn't it? I mean, we had a men's breakfast yesterday. It was great. It was about doing the race together. It's not about one person getting the prize. It's, in lots of ways, you can't take the points directly, but the focus is on the finish line and making sure that my actions, my choices now count in light of that finish line. That I will take on self-control. I will not allow my body's natural laziness to drag me down to the lowest point the whole time. I will think about everything in light of the end. Is this an encouragement to do physical exercise? Have you ever read it and thought, if you read this on your own in your quiet time, you might kind of start thinking that? Zoom out, see it in the context. No, it's not. You might have really good reason to take on an exercise regime, but it's not from here. Otherwise, it becomes a lesson in the Bible telling you how to hit your opponent better in the chin and connect with them rather than swing in the air. I mean, it's clearly not a boxing manual, is it? Don't just use this as a kind of encouragement to do physical exercise. See it for what it is. An encouragement for our mindset to be like the athlete with our focus on the prize. What about Paul's comments about being disqualified, verse 27? I think he's still building on the illustration of the race. If you start too early, if you get drugs tested, if you stray from your lane, you'll be disqualified. Just run, so none of that happens, Paul is saying. So although it's mainly fitting the illustration, does though give a glimpse of what's going to come in chapter 10, where there's quite a severe warning to the Corinthians of where their actions is taking them. This is an attitude primarily. An attitude of a mindset that has the big picture in view. And of course, it's not a reason to disobey God's law ever. Paul is not taking God's objectively good law and saying you can play around with that and subjectivize it. Don't go away from this passage ever thinking, oh, Paul is giving me a reason to kind of question some of the Bible's clear commands. No, it's not. As a family, we've visited quite a few lifeboat stations around the country. And what you can't ignore in those places is the focus on saving lives. They have roles of honour where they have the people who've done the saving named and the people who've been saved, even those people who've been pretty stupid and, you know, drifted out where they really should have known better. But every detail is listed with pride. And the whole enterprise is built on saving more people. If you go to any of those lifeboat stations around the country, you'll see that. Every bit of kit, every procedure, every redesign of the boats follows that priority. And that is Paul's mindset. Just imagine that every Christian had the mindset that Paul is calling us to. Verse 19, I've made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them. I was quite struck reading our second song this morning as we sang it. Let me remind you what we sang. Jesus said, if I am weak, I should come to him. Jesus said, if I am weak, I should come to him. He invites the weak to him. Here's a question for us this morning. If people are weak, Christian, can they come to you? If someone is weak, can they come to you confidently? Or might they be worried that actually in their weakness they'll just be further dismantled? Or will they have the confidence that in their weakness they will be built up by your love? I think that's the point, what Paul is saying in this whole section. It's not the time to prioritize our comfort, to live in paneled houses, as Haggai puts it. It is the time to be free. Enjoy your freedom as a Christian. Free from all. Yeah, we're free. Yeah, we have the cross behind, and we have Christ ahead. And that is precisely why the Christian is free enough to serve and free to lay their life down, free from the tyranny of always having to get our rights, free to make those sacrifices of rights, even good rights, if it means it's going to help others run the race well, free to walk the cross-shaped life.